This is Radio Parallax, a slightly different perspective from a slightly different view, with topics that include matters in science, technology, history, politics, current events, and whatever we damn well please. And now the host of Radio Parallax, Douglas Everett.
Welcome to the program. We can happily report to you about an excellent documentary that we bumped into, titled From Russia with Lev. The subject of the documentary is Lev Parnas, a Ukrainian, shall we say, shady operator who was deeply involved in the efforts of the Trump administration to deal with Ukraine long before the war. I think everybody is familiar with the, quote, so-called perfect phone call that Trump made to President Zelensky. But there's a lot of background to it I was very much unaware of that, again, I would recommend you check out on the documentary. And we hope to bring Stephen Harper back on the program to discuss all that. We talked about bringing someone on today's program to talk about what one can do in a practical sense to influence the voters of the swing states to vote blue. Our guest today has some personal issues to attend to, and we will, you know, try and bring her on next week. We're also pleased to report that our previous discussion of the Army Corps of Engineers and the unbelievable destruction of the American River Parkway may be gaining some legs. We hope so. We'll be returning to that topic in the weeks to come. Our website, regrettably, is down at the moment, but we hope to have it up very soon. And we will get today's show and last week's show on the website as soon as we have the opportunity. Here's truly caught a bit of a program. I can't remember where it was now, but they were discussing presidential debates. And of course, it's pretty clear that in this last debate, Kamala Harris mopped the floor with Donald J. Trump, although he's not admitting it, and his fans don't think so. I was a bit taken aback by a poll from YouGov noting that 68% of registered voters watched at least some part of the presidential debate between Harris and Trump, including 77% of Democrats, 60% of independents, and 69% of Republicans. Here's what I find stunning. 54% said Harris was the winner, while 31% said Trump was. Who are these 31%? Anyway, this program reviewed a few moments of presidential debates in the past that I'd sort of forgotten. The Nixon-Kennedy debates of 1960, of course, are what, you know, are part of American history. And I think some false history that because Nixon looked tired on television that this may have cost him the election. It is true that Kennedy, being very media savvy, he spent some time down in Hollywood seeing how things work down there, made sure that he had a nice suntan and good makeup on, and Nixon did not pay sufficient attention to his makeup. In fact, the term Richard Nixon's makeup man was a comedy punchline back in the 1960s. Anyway, I think 1960 pretty much cooled Nixon's idea on ever having a debate again, which was why in 68 and 72, none took place. But in 1976, Jimmy Carter and Gerald Ford went at it. And I remember so well watching that debate when Gerald Ford made one of the most memorable gaffes in American debate history, claiming at one point that Poland was not under Soviet domination and would not be so under a Ford administration. I mean, Jimmy Carter looked at him dumbfounded. The announcers tried to give him a way out by saying, well, Mr. President, you're not saying, I forget how they phrased it, but good old Jerry doubled down on it and said, nope. At that moment, a lot of people had some doubts about good old Jerry Ford in the Oval Office. But you know, the pattern that seems to get repeated over the years, the Democrats run some guy that's pretty sharp. The Republicans run some guy they can market. Is why former actor Ronald Reagan was a good choice for the Republicans back in 1980. You can do a lot with quips. When Carter was going off at Reagan at one point, he just sort of paused and said, oh, there you go again, which somehow resonated with the public. In 1984, there was another series of debates between then-incumbent President Reagan and challenger Walter Mondale, the vice president under Carter. But at this point in time, I think it's clear Reagan was showing some signs of, if not dementia, some mental decline. And in fact, in his first debate with Mondale, he performed abysmally. He looked lost. He looked confused. He looked out of it. But having some pretty good speechwriters and pretty canny aides behind him, in the next go-around, Reagan did a jiu-jitsu move about his age, saying in that debate he did not want age to be an issue in this campaign because he didn't think it was fair to use his opponent's youth and inexperience against him. And frankly, even Mondale had to laugh at that one. 1988, George Herbert Walker Bush debated not only Bill Clinton, but a third-party candidate, Ross Perot. And in the end, I think the spineless wimp nature of Bush 41 worked against him, going up against the bright spark of Bill Clinton. Bob Dole didn't prevail against Clinton in a three-way debate, again involving Ross Perot in 96. And then we have the 2000 debate between Al Gore and George Bush. Al Gore seemed to irk a lot of people in the country by using facts, and the dim-witted governor of Texas, W., tried to stick to the script they gave him and benefited from Rupert Murdoch and Fox News and others, finding that Al Gore had apparently sighed at a couple of points during the debate, and they kept playing those sighs as if that, I don't know, meant something. Then we have 04, 2004, John Kerry against W. Now, we here at Radio Parallax were on the air at the time and noted, as did some outlets in the media, but not enough, that it appeared that George Bush was wired. Photos taken from behind the lecterns showed that he had a lump in his suit jacket and apparently a microphone in his ear. I must say, it really wasn't enough. Kerry pretty much mopped the floor with him. But again, when it came to Election Day, was John Kerry the president? No. Well, there's more to that story. But anyway, doing bad in a debate is not necessarily fatal. Donald J. Trump looked like the moron that he is last month. But unfortunately, he still enjoys the support of many people. And frankly, is a lead pipe cinch certainty to carry 22 or 23 states and probably more. Anyway, I mention all this because I'm looking at last week's edition of The Week magazine, which on the cover posed the question, will Trump's debate meltdown cost him the election? And my answer to that is, based on history, not necessarily. And you know, Mr. Miller, I think we need to lighten the mood here. So let's do our perennial favorite, the good, the bad, and the ugly. According to the Week magazine, it was a good week last week for, I guess you'd say, trying to be an adult, with the news that an 8-year-old girl took an SUV from her family's Ohio home and drove 10 miles to the local Target. Police said they found the girl safe inside the store on a shopping spree. Officer said, "We did let her finish her Frappuccino. We're not mean." On the other hand, it was surely a bad week for trying to be an adult, with the news that the police chief of Bridgewater State University in Massachusetts has confirmed news reports that he's moved to Florida as of 2023. David Tillinghast, who makes $172,000 a year, said he remains, quote, in constant communication, unquote, with the university. And what do you know? It was an ugly week last week, I would say, for trying to be an adult, with the news that Robert F. Kennedy Jr., is now being investigated by the National Marine Fisheries Service over those recently resurfaced claims that he chainsawed the head off a dead whale and drove home with it strapped to the roof of his car. At a Trump rally, Kennedy said, "This is all about the weaponization of our government."
As I was walking down by the seaside, I saw a large whale floating on the tide. He measured as long as a great schooner's stick. I looked, and by gum, it was old Moby Dick. Now what do you think I made of his head? As large an oven as ever baked bread.
And a news item that is not good, but is definitely bad, with quite a bit of ugly thrown in, we have this. Ford has filed a patent to collect information from motorists and target them with ads as they drive. The data would include the vehicle's destination and route, and this is the best part, as well as conversations happening between human occupants, all of which would help determine the ads shown on car screens. A Ford spokesman said, "No matter what the patent application outlines, we will always put the customer first." Or at least the people that want to know what the customer's talking about inside the car. I think they come first. Well, Elon Musk made the news, as he constantly does, but he made the news last week with his attack on Vinod Khosla, who lost a legal challenge in his effort to keep Martin's Beach sequestered. After Musk attacked Khosla, Khosla shot back a query about his affiliation and love of Donald Trump, which then caused Musk to call him an a-hole. Oh, those billionaires! And speaking of Musk, the question was asked in Wired magazine of how it is that Elon Musk continues to get away with some of the things he gets away with. Andrew Kautz, writing in Wired, said, "Elon Musk is a national security risk. Given that there have been two attempts to assassinate Donald Trump, Musk wondered this week on his social media site, X, why, quote, no one is even trying to assassinate Biden/Kamala, end quote, with an emoji indicating suspicion. It's noted that to Musk's right-wing fanboys, the comment might sound like a suggestion that a sitting president and possible successor deserve their own assassination attempts. After claiming he was just joking, Musk took the post down. Ms. Merrill notes that he believes that the Secret Service then spoke to Musk after this. Frankly, I wish they had spanked Mr. Musk after this. Anyway, my good friend from medical school days, Joel Holtz, Dr. Holtz, paid me a visit last week and mentioned how his son had apparently written a very persuasive essay to the good people at Stanford, which assisted his matriculation at the university. This reminded yours truly of a very memorable piece of writing, which we reported on when we first did this show 24 years ago. And you know, since we're going to get pretty heavy here for the remainder of the show, let's do a little hiatus for some levity. This is purportedly the actual essay that a guy used to get himself accepted at NYU several years back, something like in the early 90s. The author of this essay, Hugh Gallagher, now attends NYU. Asked NYU, "In order for the admission staff of our college to get to know you, the applicant, better, we ask that you answer the following question. Are there any significant experiences you have had or accomplishments you have realized that have helped to define you as a person?" Responded Mr. Gallagher, "I'm a dynamic figure, often seen scaling walls and crushing ice. I've been known to remodel train stations on my lunch breaks, making them more efficient in the area of heat retention. I translate ethnic slurs for Cuban refugees. I write award-winning operas. Occasionally, I tread water for 3 days in a row. I woo women with my sensuous and godlike trombone playing. I can pilot bicycles up severe inclines with unflagging speed, and I cook 30-minute brownies in 20 minutes. I'm an expert in stucco, a veteran in love, and an outlaw in Peru. I am an abstract artist, a concrete analyst, and a ruthless bookie. Critics worldwide swoon over my original line of corduroy evening wear. I don't perspire. I'm a private citizen, yet I receive fan mail. Last summer, I toured New Jersey with a traveling centrifugal force demonstration. I bat 400. I can hurl tennis rackets at small moving objects with deadly accuracy. While on vacation in Canada, I successfully negotiated with a group of terrorists who had seized a small bakery. The laws of physics do not apply to me. I have won bullfights in San Juan, cliff diving competitions in Sri Lanka, and a spelling bee at the Kremlin. I balance, I weave, I dodge, I frolic, and my bills are all paid. On weekends, to let off steam, I participate in full contact origami. I've played Hamlet, I've spoken with Elvis, but I have not yet gone to college." Okay, funny stuff, but now we need to get serious. If you're like me, you probably know some Republicans or MAGA people, which are not identical, as we'll talk about that as we go along. But you undoubtedly know people that when you criticize the orange man, they will say things like, "Are you a hater?" Which usually gives me pause, but because when you consider the amount of vitriol and hate that Trump has been spewing since he got political, and of course, even before that, you have to wonder how it is that these same people have apparently a double standard, that hate originating from Donald Trump gets a pass, whereas any dislike directed back at him is criticized. I do remember a heated argument back from about, I don't know, the early 1960s when I was a boy and my slightly older cousin were going at it. I took offense to something he said, and God knows I have no recollection of exactly what that was. But his rebuttal to me was, "You can dish it out, but you can't take it." And that might have been somewhat true regarding myself as a young boy, but it is definitely, definitely true regarding the man who was the 45th president. The feelings of the MAGA crowd seem to get hurt so easily. Talk about your world-class snowflakes. But I'm not sure we could do better than to air a segment that aired on MSNBC with Joe Connison, etc., talking about this issue. Specifically in this case, whether it's fair or unfair to refer to Donald Trump as a threat to democracy. Mr. McMillan?
So last hour, we started debunking the false narratives that we are seeing play out in the presidential election. A big one is the false equivalencies on violent rhetoric. Last week, the deputy editorial page director of the Wall Street Journal, Daniel Henninger, wrote a column entitled "Killing Trump." He glosses over all the things Trump has said and done to promote violence, justify violence, glorify violence, and laugh at violence. Henninger writes, quote, "Yes, we know the legal details, the abhorrent events of January 6th, and the role of Mr. Trump's own rhetoric. But do Democrats think this nonstop assault on a person who twice got about half the country's popular presidential vote would be cost-free, that it would have no negative effect on the psychological health of America's public life?" You have to love the way the conventional wisdom shows up at moments like this, proclaiming that we need to tone it down. It might be a little late for that.
Tone it down. And again, he says nothing about Donald Trump. What Donald Trump said after they caught the guy at the golf course.
Let's go through it. The argument is that the media and the Harris campaign need to stop talking about the very real threat Trump poses to American democracy. I talk about facts. Bill Maher took on that argument on his show on Friday.
Of course, he's absolutely right that we probably should tone it down when we're calling our opponents the end of democracy, the end of Western civilization. We're not helping our arguments.
I disagree. That's a dumb argument, I think, because you what? No, that's their argument, which is that you guys are saying Trump is a threat to democracy. But he is a threat to democracy. The answer can't be that we can't say what's true. I want to say what's true. And the left has to do that, too.
Since January 6th, Donald Trump has consistently made those threats. Remember what he said that day at the Ellipse? Isn't stoking a violent insurgency a threat to democracy?
And we fight. We fight like hell. And if you don't fight like hell, you're not going to have a country anymore.
Is saying your vice president should have been hanged a threat to democracy? White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, according to an account provided to the House Committee investigating January 6th, told the colleagues that Trump had said something to the effect of maybe Mr. Pence should have been hanged. Is saying the Biden family should have been arrested 2 weeks before the 2020 election a threat to democracy?
That Biden family and others, but that Biden family is corrupt. It's a corrupt family. And with me and my kids, let me tell you, my kids, I'll tell you something, though, and it's right, lock them up. You should lock them up. Lock up the Bidens. Lock up Hillary. Lock them up.
By the way, he pressured his own attorney general 2 weeks before the election, Bill Barr, to throw Joe Biden in jail. His political opponent pressured him 2 weeks before the election to throw his political opponent in jail, like they do in Belarus, like they do in Russia.
Is calling the January 6th rioters patriots, hostages, promising to pardon them on day one, a threat to democracy?
The moment we win, we will rapidly review the cases of every political prisoner unjustly victimized by the Harris regime, and I will sign their pardons on day one.
Is threatening to execute the Joint Chiefs of Staff a threat to democracy? Because that's what Trump suggested in a social media post when ranting about retired General Mark Milley. Is mocking the brutal beating of a political rival's spouse a threat to democracy?
Kamala Harris and the radical liberals force anarchy on the American people while they live in safety, in many cases behind walls. You know that? Nancy Pelosi has a big wall wrapped around her house. Of course, it didn't help too much with the problem she had, did it?
Is promising to be a dictator for a day a threat to democracy?
Under no circumstances, you are promising America tonight. You would never abuse power as retribution against anybody.
Except for day one.
Except
Look,
what?
He's going crazy. Except for day one.
Meaning?
I want to close the border and I want to drill. He says, you're not going to be a dictator, are you? I said, no, 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 other than day one. We're closing the border and we're drilling, drilling, drilling. After that, I'm not a dictator.
He's repeatedly said he's going to be a dictator on day one.
Is telling supporters if he wins the election, they will never have to vote again a threat to democracy?
You won't have to do it anymore. Four more years. You know what? It'll be fixed. It'll be fine. You won't have to vote anymore, my beautiful Christians. I love you, Christians. I'm a Christian. I love you. Get out. You got to get out and vote. In 4 years, you don't have to vote again. We'll have it fixed so good you're not going to have to vote.
Is vowing to terminate the Constitution a threat to democracy? Trump did that in another social media post while rambling and lying about the 2020 election. Is refusing to admit he lost the last election and sowing doubt in the result of this election a threat to democracy? Trump has done that for years and still refuses to accept he lost in 2020 in what top government and industry officials have called the most secure election in American history.
Make no mistake, this election was stolen from you, from me, and from the country.
There was never a second of any day that I didn't believe that that election was rigged. It was a rigged election. It was a rigged election, and it was a stolen, disgusting election. And this country should be ashamed.
We got to stop the cheating. If we stop that cheating, if we don't let them cheat, I don't even have to campaign anymore. We're going to win by so much. In the meantime, too big to rig. Too big to rig.
So what do you call that? I'm wondering what you call that. And for those people that said, oh, nothing happened in his first term. Yeah, January 6th happened in his first term. The attempt to overthrow American democracy, to throw out a presidential election because he didn't like the outcome, happened. All those things Mika said happened in the first term. And there are people actually writing this weekend. Oh, and on Bill Maher going, oh, you know what? Nothing really happened in the first term. We got by it. OK, we survived. Yeah, we survived. Democracy survived in spite of Donald Trump. Democracy survived in spite of his efforts with federal courts, people in the media, local Republican officials in Michigan, in Georgia, in Pennsylvania. Yeah, we survived. We survived in spite of everything that Donald Trump tried to do in the first term.
All right, we have another segment to do, which you should definitely stick around for, dear listener. We're going to delve into some of the things that are being said on YouTube and elsewhere, presumably about Donald J. Trump and this election. Stick around.